Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining us for today's podcast titled Coronavirus Facts Only. Every day around this time, I'm talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about coronavirus and COVID-19. What do we need to know? How do we keep ourselves safe? And what lies ahead in the uncertain future? Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's always my pleasure.
So we are at May 18th, and we've got certain restrictions lifting in St. Louis City and St. Louis County. What's your main message to people as we see these new restrictions start to ease?
I think the big one is just to still be intelligent. We've talked about a lot last week, and it seems with increasing confidence where this really spreads is in where people are vulnerable is in these kind of not just close contact, but prolonged contact in areas where there's not good air movement and people are kind of in the same confined space for a while. So a restaurant, a bar that's crowded, even if you're spaced out, if there's not good airflow, people that are like farther away than that 6 feet that we've always talked about still get sick. And there's been more and more studies kind of showing that effect. So, you know, I think being careful where you patronize, what you do, using the right precautions is important. So, you know, again, good hand washing, face mask, just do things that are, you know, critical and important. I was talking to somebody over the weekend, and, you know, we've been kind of in place now for, almost 2 months now. And to just go out in one day and just kind of blow all that discipline just seems really silly for me for something that doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, so this person was going to go exchange some clothes at a store that I know is going to be super crowded. And you're just like, why? I mean, is this worth getting sick over? I mean, just wait a little bit longer or, you know, worst comes to worst, eat the cost of that, you know, thing you're going to exchange. This is just the place where, you know, don't throw caution to the wind, just still, you know, be, have that trepidation. Cause I see the videos and pictures of bars in Wisconsin for the weekend, and I'm ill looking at it because I know it's going to happen. You know, every time you see a group of people that just kind of seem to defy science or defy nature, I get nervous. I'm just like, I know what's coming with that, and I hope I'm wrong, but it just seems every single time people flaunt the rules of what nature does to us, a payment is collected. And that payment is people getting very, very sick and some people dying. And that's silly and avoidable. And that's what just drives me nuts, frankly.
So how long till we begin to see some results of this partial reopening?
Yeah, I think by early to mid-June, we'll have a sense of what this does. I think most people are going to say, if they're candid, that they expect an increase in cases. And that's, I think that's the cost of this. The question is it an increase in cases to the extent that our healthcare system can't deal with that capacity? And, you know, that's the question that's hard to figure out and hard to model and hard to determine. The last thing you want is what happened in New York or Detroit or Seattle or New Orleans. I mean, that's you know, it's not just the people getting sick. It's the way COVID seems to overwhelm our healthcare capacity, particularly for very, very sick people, that like I said many times before, it just, that sheer fact or, you know, phenomenon is what just totally, I'm in awe of just how quickly we get overwhelmed and just seems to come out of nowhere. And so that's to me the biggest worry. And again, I look at Texas right now. Texas was one of the first states to kind of reopen in defiance of things. And, you know, they had the biggest increase in cases over the weekend. And you know, does that system have the capacity to deal with that? I think it remains to be seen. It just seems like a gamble. And I just, you know, I get the reasons why. And I'd like to do this with some intelligence. And to be fair, I think the region has done this as best as they can, given the limitations nationally we have. And so we'll see. Time will tell.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, we're hearing a lot today about a vaccine trial by Moderna that's showing some potential promise. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so this is an initial trial. And again, when you first do vaccine studies or any kind of studies with any kind of drug, the things you're looking at first is basically, one, is it safe? You know, so is it causing harm to, you know, use this as done in healthy participants? Two, does it elicit the response that you want? So vaccines, one of the ways you can kind of test for this is a search for antibodies, meaning does giving the person the vaccine stimulate the immune response that provides immunity for further infections, which is mediated or driven by the presence of antibodies. And so this vaccine showed that it develops antibodies in the patients or the participants in the trial. You know, again, that's a nice first step. That means at least it's doing something. You know, the next step, does it actually confer real immunity? And then, you know, as you do, you know, second and third phase trials, you're really testing, you know, whether by giving people this vaccine, does it prevent people from getting sick from the vaccine or from the virus, from coronavirus in this case. And so, you know, again, that we can rush this along. The development part is easy. We can develop a molecule in a second. It's doing these tests that take a long time. You know, you have to give people the vaccine and see if they get sick or not, basically. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. But you can't just do that in a day. You've got to give them the vaccine and watch them over a period of time and see if they get sick or not. And that's, you know, that's not done overnight. It just takes some time to do. But it's nice. At least we're seeing some promise. And again, there's lots of things out there that show promise. You know, but the medical field is full of things that show promise. But when you do the trials to see if they really work, they go by the wayside. And again, this is a frustration of any kind of development, of any drug, of any vaccine. It's a process that's met with a lot of roadblocks. It just takes time to work through all those.
So what about those hopes to have something by the end of the year?
I'm just incredibly skeptical. I mean, a good vaccine trial, you know, to really show efficacy, it's got to take a couple of months, you know, and so you're just now in the first phase. They've got to do some more kind of what they call second phase trials just to see if it's something that can be done on a population of people. And then you've got to see if it works on, you know, people that would potentially get sick. And so, you know, just getting, you know, assuming we can move as fast as we can. And again, I think there's some intelligence in how we're doing this. We're doing multiple things in parallel. So usually a company will do, you know, they'll do one molecule, try it, see it fail, try another molecule, so on and so forth. You know, there's a push to do multiple things at once, which is good. So there's lots of, you know, irons in the fire. But yeah, again, it's going to take some time you just have to see how this works, and that just takes time. So I think by, even if we found something that was work and showed efficacy by the end of the year, the calendar year, you still then have to manufacture and ramp up manufacturing. So we've got a long way to go until this is ready and a panacea for us. So I think holding on that is a fool's errand. We've got so much other important work to do, which is being prepared for the summer and winter months, ramping up our testing capabilities, making sure we have equipment to do the work we need to do. And, you know, really, like we talked about before, flattening the curve, just making sure that the cases stay at least even so we can at least deal with it. We've got to avoid these spikes. If we have a spike in this region, we're toast. And I can't emphasize that enough. Just look at New York. It just, this overwhelms so quickly. I've never seen anything like this in my career. I don't think any physician that's practiced right now has seen something like this in his career, in their career. This is just out of bounds, anything we're used to dealing with. And we've got to be paranoid about that. And I don't know if that paranoia is the right word, but it's not wrong either.
We're talking with SLU Care's Dr. Fred Buchholz, a general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. So in the meantime, we focus on treatments. What's the range of treatments being offered for COVID-19?
Yeah, so, you know, still the vast majority of things is what we would call supportive care. So again, and remember, most people with COVID, the vast majority of COVID patients are asymptomatic. They don't have any symptoms whatsoever. Or, you know, what we call kind of the general viral symptoms. So, you know, a number of people will just feel terrible, fevers, aches, shortness of breath. Some people have, I think a fair amount of people have stomach upset, either nausea or diarrhea or both. But the ones that really worry us are the people that develop what we would call systemic response to infection. So, you know, their body's immune system becomes so active trying to fight off infection that causes damage. And that's where you hear about the blood clots and all these other kind of secondary symptoms that come with COVID. And then, you know, the other very severe thing is respiratory failure, where there's an inability for the body to adequately get enough oxygen in to the body. And that requires, you know, usually some degree of support, either oxygen or, in the worst case scenarios, being on a ventilator or some of the more fancy equipment. And that's really, you know, again, we're learning some different techniques to deal with that. You'll hear about people getting proning, which means instead of lying on the back, we lie them on their belly just to improve. That improves a little bit of ventilation, although you can't do that for too long because it has other problems associated with it. We've changed a lot of our ventilator techniques as well. You know, people are always trying new things, which is great. Just read about something called nitric oxide adding to the flow of oxygen, which seems to have some benefit. Again, just an ancillary report. It's not a proven thing, but it's being studied. And then there's the new drug remdesivir, which you know, the official results are not yet out yet, but the NIH reports that it improves symptoms by about 4 days, 15 to 11 days, I think is the number. There might be a mortality benefit, but it wasn't fully seen, or it wasn't significant in terms of the statistics we've done. But that seems to have some promise. There's some additional therapies that are being trialed out now to kind of dampen the immune system. But that's essentially it. I mean, I think most patients now, if they're severely ill, are going to get remdesivir. You know, the question is just supply more than anything at this point. But, you know, other than the kind of these kind of, you know, ad hoc things, really it's that idea of supportive care and just hope people write out, or we can just, you know, keep them going long enough that their body doesn't completely shut down and that eventually they'll recover. That's certainly the hope.
Do treatments differ from hospital to hospital?
You know, not so much. I think one is the ability of the drug supply and perhaps maybe the capabilities of the hospital. So, you know, most hospitals have an ICU. You know, the question is that the capabilities of people and the staffing that ICU. So if you're in a rural area, you know, there's really good physicians and staff in those hospitals, but they may not have enough critical care trained physicians to staff an ICU. They're small enough just to kind of tie people over. And if they get incredibly ill, they usually get transferred to a big center such as, you know, Mercy out in Creve Coeur, Barnes, or us, where we have, you know, a huge range of equipment and expertise to take care of the sickest of the sick. So, you know, I think that's probably the biggest factor of all this is, you know, does the hospital have all the equipment needed to do the job they do? And for the most part, in the St. Louis region, the answer is yes. You know, most hospitals you go to will be able to adequately handle somebody with COVID. Worst case scenario, I mean, there are people getting transferred to these other centers. Mine is an example. You know, if there's something more specific needed, you'll hear about this device or system called ECMO, which is a pretty radical device. It just basically takes your blood and the machine takes your blood and acts as lungs for you, and it kind of adds oxygen to your blood. So it's a very labor-intensive, requires a lot of resources type of machine, and not many places have that. So, but that's, those fortunately are just in the extreme case and not done incredibly often, which is great because they're pretty, it's a pretty dramatic thing to put somebody on that.
Does it make sense for a patient to maybe shop around to see where they'd want to go, or does it matter?
You know, I think if you're sick, the most important thing is to get to the closest place. Once you're having respiratory symptoms and you're needing support, time is money. And so, I get to the quickest place. And if they have a issue of being able to provide the right resources to you, they'll try to arrange a transfer to a higher acuity care facility. But I think getting to the closest place is most important. You can look at, it's hard to tell with a lot of different things of where, and this is, again, I think at the expense of not trying to diverge too much, how hospitals do and what's the difference between hospitals is a very opaque thing. It's dependent on a lot of factors. It's hard to get good data about, is a hospital I'm going to a good hospital? If I go there, do I have better or worse odds of living or dying than going to another hospital? That information's, it's hard to figure out and it's hard to know. But I think, generally most hospitals in the region do a very solid job. There's none that are, in my mind, not worthy of providing great care to the community. I think locality is probably the one thing. And the different types of treatments, everybody's giving convalescent plasma, I think at this point, or at least in major centers. I think it's just more where you feel comfortable and what you're close to is probably the biggest thing.
We're talking with SLU Care's Dr. Fred Buchholz, a general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, is treating COVID-19 kind of like treating a bunch of different diseases because the symptoms differ so much in different patients?
It is, but there's other diseases that do this too. I mean, pretty much anybody that has a bad infection, if you're experienced enough, you've got to be ready for a lot of different things to happen. I mean, the amazing thing, frankly, and I say this, I'm not sure if the word I'm using right now is great, but what makes my job fun, honestly, is the challenge that infections provide. Even with all our technology and all our ability, nature itself just throws a curveball all the time. And what I'll tell people I train and people I work with is, how I earn my salary is not knowing everything about everything with medicine, but, being able to see when people don't, make a turn or do something unpredicted and be able to quickly understand what's going on with that and try to adapt to that as quick as I can. And, none of us are perfect at that. In fact, I giving away trade secrets here, but if I'm right 60% of the time, I'm doing my job pretty well, which is kind of, I'm sure, terrifying to most people to hear, but that's just how hard this job can be. And COVID's just kind of a perfect microcosm of that, it can do different things to different people. We can't predict who's going to do well, who's not. And that's the, the crux of our business. Just to kind of tell a story about this is, our lives as physicians are full of these antidotes of, you hear about a patient and you'll look at their numbers, so to speak. So their vital signs and their labs, images, holy cow, this person's, sicker than it's not. How, my goodness, we got to panic. And you run down and go check on the patient, whether in the emergency room or the ICU. And they're sitting there talking to you, eating a sandwich, saying, "Hey, doc, how's it going?" And they look totally fine. And then you go about another patient and they're telling, some of the colleagues will be telling you about this is they may be giving you this patient to admit to the hospital. And you're looking at things and everything looks great. Their blood pressure is good. All their labs are perfectly normal. And the person you're talking to is like, "Yeah, I just don't know. I don't like this." And you go down, you see the patient, they look terrible. Everything on the computer screen says they should be fine. And you look at this person, you say, "I don't like this. This isn't good." And that's just, the culmination of a lot of training and experience, but that shows you how unpredictable everything is. And with COVID, the same thing. When I was taking care of patients a couple weeks ago, there's one person where I'm like, there's nothing here that looks good. And I look at this patient, and he's just totally fine, looks great. Then another person says, "I feel completely fine." And bear in mind, I was on this service late April, and she's like, she felt completely fine, but her oxygen levels were really low. she's still in the ICU. This is May 18th. And so it blows your mind how variable this is and how unpredictable this is. And you're just always on your toes dealing with this. And given since we first started really talking about this in March, how much we've learned and how much our practice has changed in 2 months is frankly incredible. Again, I've never seen anything like this where we've changed our tactics and our strategies dealing with this on the fly a number of times. It's fascinating. It's terrifying and fascinating at the same time.
I think you mentioned this a bit earlier. Tell us a little bit more about nitric oxide and how that might be used to help patients breathe easier.
Yeah, good question. Nobody knows. some think that there is thought that nitric oxide, it's used in the body. Your body makes nitric oxide as part of an inflammatory or a response to treat inflammation. So, you know, I remember when I was a resident, I was really interested in nitric oxide and mitigating some of the aspects of diabetes. And so it does, on a cellular level, does help a lot of different things. Now, a couple groups have tried just giving it to patients kind of as a supplement to oxygen who are having a hard time breathing, and they did better. And again, this is just a trial. This is just an experiment. It's not like you compared it to people just getting oxygen alone, so you don't really know. But, you know, there's some thought of maybe it has some anti-inflammatory effects. I suspect it might augment or change how oxygen, might ease oxygen exchange in the lungs. And I think that might be how it works, but nobody really knows for sure. It was just an idea, and it seemed to work a little bit, so people are trying it, and now they're studying it in a kind of a more effective way.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for your time today. Really do appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Fred.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. This is KMOX health editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks so much for joining us for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Talk to you again tomorrow.